I've got good news and I've got bad news. Which do you want to hear? Most people would say the bad news. Now, I realize that some people say they want to hear the bad news first so they get it over with and then they get to the good news. Okay, I get that. But I think in our culture, most people would just as soon hear the bad news. You look at our society and bad news seems to win out much of the time. We seem to be addicted to bad news. What stories lead off the evening news? Good or bad? It's always the bad. What captures the headlines? Bad news. What's the largest selling publications in America? Tabloids. And what are they full of? Bad news. They exploit tragedy and misery, particularly of the rich and the famous. And if there isn't enough of it, they just make it up. I saw a study this last week. Two of the popular tabloids, one is called OK and the other is called The Star. They were less than accurate. Or let me put it this way. They were accurate less than 10% of the time on their cover stories, less than 15% of the time on the inside of their magazines. And yet, those publications fly off the shelves and people eat it up. Why? Why do we as Americans thrive on this stuff? I think songwriter Don Henley might have got it right when he sang this. Dirty little secrets, dirty little lies, we got our dirty little fingers in everybody's pie. Love to cut you down to size, we love dirty laundry. I guess true. As a culture, we love dirty laundry, unless it's our own. We love to hear about the pain and the misery of others, as long as it's somebody else's. But I come back to that basic question. Why? I think that our text this morning provides the answer. Tucked away in the midst of the love chapter, we read in 1 Corinthians 13:6, love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. I like the way the Jewish New Testament renders this phrase. Love doesn't gloat over other people's sins, but takes delight in the truth. Now, Paul combines a negative and a positive aspect to describe the role of truth in the love relationship. You see, for the apostle, agape is an intersection of truth, salvation, and obedience to God. Love and truth are inseparable. They always have been. They always go together. When you find one, you find the other. You find love, you'll find truth. If you find truth, you find love. And when you seek the highest good of another, truth is absolutely essential. See, true love is not happy to see other people sin or suffer. Agape love wants truth to win out. It's happy when it does. Now, of course, this is exactly the opposite of our world. But does that surprise us? John wrote in 1 John 2:15, do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. The world is diametrically opposed to the kind of love that God gives, the kind of love that God calls us to exhibit in our relationships. So this morning I'd like to take a look at both sides, the negative and the positive, in love's relationship as it has to do with truth, as it has to do with good news and bad news. First, we see that love does not delight in evil. But as we pointed out, our culture does. Our culture delights in the evil that goes on. It's all too characteristic of human nature to take pleasure in the misfortune of others. And I'm calling this morning self's egotistical enjoyment of evil. Because I think it demonstrates why people take this perverse delight when things go wrong. And it takes several manifestations. First, it boosts our own ego. It makes us feel better when other people are cut down, doesn't it? You know, people that maybe they don't feel so good about themselves, so instead of raising themselves up, they want to bring others around them down. because then by comparison, they feel better about themselves. See, by nature, we're all insecure. Now, I know some people are better at hiding it than others, but insecurity is a part of our fallen nature. And instead of using our insecurity as a motivation to make ourselves better, we'd rather tear other people down around us, bring them down to our perceived level. Francis Schaeffer warns against this as he writes, "Each time I see something wrong in others, it can be dangerous, for it can exalt self. And when this happens, my open fellowship with God falls to the ground. So when I am right, I can be wrong. In the midst of being right, if self is exalted, my fellowship with God can be destroyed." Now, it's not wrong to be right, nor to say that wrong is wrong, but it is wrong to have a wrong attitude in being right, and to forget that my relationship with my fellow man must always be personal and as equals. If I really love a man as I love myself, I will long to see him be what he could be on the basis of Christ's work. For that is what I want, or what I should want for myself on the basis of Christ's work. And if it is otherwise, not only is my communication with that man broken, but my communication with God as well. For this is sin, breaking the second commandment to love my neighbor as myself. This remains true even if the man is desperately wrong and I am right. When 1 Corinthians 13 says love does not rejoice in iniquity, it means exactly what it says. When we find another man to be wrong, we are not to rejoice in his iniquity. And how careful I must be every time I see a situation where I am right and another man is wrong, not to use it as an excuse to scramble into a superior position over that one, rather than remembering the proper relationship of fellow creatures before God. You see, when we find someone or we see someone who is caught in sin or maybe caught in the consequences of sin, we need to look at them the way God looks at them. And that does not mean in judgment. God looks at the sinner with love. Yes, He can and He will judge the sin. But His main attitude towards sinners is love. Aren't you glad for that? Because we all fall into that category. And as His children, we are called to have the similar attitude toward those who are caught in sin or the consequences of sin. Paul writes in Galatians 6:1, "Brothers, if someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently. But watch yourself, or you may also be tempted." Now, I used to think that last phrase meant that we could be tempted by the same sin that that person is caught in, and I guess that's true. But I really think he means we could get tempted in the sin of pride. Because when we see somebody caught in a sin, and maybe we are in the process of restoring them and picking them up, it's very easy to think to ourselves, "Boy, I'm glad I'm not in that sin. Thank God I didn't commit that sin." You see how I can feed our ego? And it can blossom into pride that we are better than that other person. And secondly, someone's downfall can mean our own gain. You know, we hear that a business competitor suffered a setback. That could mean more profits our way. A fellow worker gets into trouble. That might mean a better job for us or higher seniority. Even within the church, we might be tempted to celebrate, albeit privately, when that person who always seems to get the solo or always seems to get that committee chair, oh, they're kind of taken out of the way. See, there's a certain mean streak in human nature that takes pleasure in what is wrong, especially if that benefits oneself. This reminds me of an account told in 2 Samuel chapter 1. It's what happened after the death of King Saul. Saul, we know, was a man that was chosen by God to be the first king of Israel. He had all that it would take to be the king, but he became proud. He became kind of full of himself. And he eventually lost the favor of God. Ultimately, Saul lost his life on the battlefield. And we also know that David was anointed by Samuel under the direction of God to be the next king. And David knew that whenever Saul passed on, he would become king. Unfortunately, Saul also knew that. And for 10 years, David's running for his life from Saul because Saul wanted to kill him. So now Saul is dead. Saul dies on the field of battle along with all but one of his sons. And David is now going to be king. Everybody knew it. But what happens in 2 Samuel chapter 1 is that a man appears to David, because David was not a part of the battle in which Saul was killed. He was off somewhere else. And this man comes, he was an Amalekite. He comes to David and says, "I bring you news." Now, in essence, it was bad news, but he thought it would be good news to David. "Saul the king, your enemy, is dead. I bring to you his crown and the armband that he wore as proof that Saul is dead." David questions him a little bit further. He says, Well, how do you know this? He says, "Well, I was there on the field of battle. Saul was wounded, and he asked me to, in essence, put him out of his misery before the enemy could capture him alive. And so I did. And here is the crown and the armband." Now, for one thing, the story isn't true. See, we know from 1 Samuel that Saul asked his armor bearer to kill him when he was wounded. His armor bearer wouldn't do it because you don't lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. And Saul took his own life. That's the truth. But the Amalekite is thinking, "I'm going to be the bearer of bad news and I'm going to get a handsome profit from this." David's going to be so happy that he hears that his enemy is dead. Now he's king. Maybe he'll give me some kind of a bonus. You know what the bonus was? Off with his head. Because David said, "What do you mean you laid your hands on the Lord anointed? You just sentenced yourself to die. The man was executed before the day was out." See, here was a man that thought that the bad news of Saul could profit himself. He thought he could gain by somebody else's downfall. It didn't work out so well for him. And in contrast, you look at this story and you see David's reaction to Saul's death. Now, David, you might think, would celebrate this bad news, because Saul's demise meant David was now safe. The man who had been hunting him down for 10 years is gone. Not only that, he's now the king. Saul is gone. David can now ascend to the throne. But how does David react? He mourned. He wept bitterly. As one commentary puts it, it was surely a mark of greatness on David's part that instead of rejoicing over Saul's death, he wept bitterly. He refused to allow the downfall of his enemy to be the cause of his joy, even though Saul's death meant that David would become king. This takes a lot of godliness. It takes a lot of agape love. Now, a third reason why our sin nature delights in evil is that it can justify our own sin. See, we can find this false kind of peace in seeing others fail and seeing others fall, presumably because it imagines that it gives us more leeway to trifle with sin ourselves. And we might see somebody else stumble in sin and we say, "Oh, well, you know, if they did that, then, you know, what I do isn't so bad." We can justify our own sin in our minds. I think this might explain the rather bizarre passage in 1 Corinthians 5. Remember, Paul is writing this love chapter in the midst of this book of 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 5, Paul confronts the church on a matter that he says is so awful. It is so scandalous. It's something so evil the heathen don't even do it. And it was happening right there in the church. a man was living with his stepmother in sin. But the interesting part about it is, after Paul mentions the sin, he says, and you people are proud of it. It's bad enough that you have this incestuous relationship going on in your midst, but you people are proud of it? You think it's great? Why? Why would people think that that's a good thing? I think it's because when people say, well, if so-and-so's living with his stepmother, yeah, it's not such a big deal what I do. See how we can reason that way? We can justify something that we think is lesser because somebody else did something worse. And that's one reason why people can delight in evil. Oh, well, somebody else did this. Now, yeah, God's not going to care if I do this little thing. Oh, yes, He does. So we've got to be very careful that we don't allow other people's sin to become a justification of our own. So whether it makes us feel better about ourselves, our situation, or our sin, it is never acceptable to delight in anything bad that happens to somebody, whether they deserved it or not. And I know that's hard. I know it's tempting. You know, you hear something that happens, maybe it's somebody you don't particularly care for yourself. Come on, what's your reaction? Couldn't happen to a nicer guy, right? Come on. Anybody else ever thought that? Am I the only one? I mean, it's human nature. We tend to do that, but that's exactly the opposite of the kind of love that God wants us to have. Instead, Paul commends love's respectable rejoicing with right. Love takes no joy in evil of any kind, but it rejoices with the truth. You see, God's kind of love prefers good news to bad news. It rejoices with those who rejoice. It doesn't allow petty jealousy or selfishness to put a damper on someone else's victories. That's not easy to do. You know, sometimes it's easier to weep with those who weep than to rejoice with those who rejoice, because when someone's rejoicing, that means that they've done well. That's hard to do. I remember playing Little League. The end of every game, the two teams had to meet midfield and shake hands. That's tough to do when you're on the losing side. And I can remember several times it was through clenched teeth that you would walk up to the opposing team and say, good game. It's hard to do. I don't know, maybe we should still follow that practice as adults sometimes, you know? We kind of lose that when we get older. Philippians 4:8 provides us a list of the kind of things love focuses its attention on. Paul writes, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Now, Kenneth Wiest, who is a Greek scholar, writes, the word think in the Greek speaks of an act of careful reflection. You can almost put the word meditate here. Meditate on these things. Focus on them. Focus your attention on these kinds of things. And then he adds how scarce a commodity this is in our technological age. And that's true. You know, nowadays, we let machines do our thinking for us, right? Whether it's calculators or computers or whatever. It's so much easier to let something else do our thinking for us. But love carefully reflects, meditates on what is good and what is right. It also shows that love isn't just an emotion. It's not just a feeling. It's something we can focus our minds on and think about these things. Dwell on these things. Now, you take that list of Philippians 4:8. Grab, well, don't buy it, but if you ever happen to come across a tabloid, see how many of those things in Philippians 4:8 you'll find in a tabloid. Probably none. You may not even be able to find it in your local newspaper or the television news or, you know, Inside Edition or Inside Hollywood, one of these gossip TV shows. You won't find anything true, noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable. None of that stuff. But this is exactly the kind of thing that the mind controlled by love dwells on. And don't try to excuse yourself thinking that you're helpless when our minds are filled with unwanted thoughts. Fact of the matter is, we can help it. The Bible tells us that we can control what we think. Truth be told, there is always something positive and right we can focus on if we choose to. Now, in some situations, with some people, it might be a little more challenging than others, but look for it. Look for something good and positive. You will find it eventually. See, love looks for the best in others, and it rejoices when right prevails. Yeah, but you say, what about all the bad things that are in the world? I mean, it's still true. There's a lot of bad things. There's a lot of bad people. Are we supposed to just ignore all of the evil in the world and, you know, stick our heads in the sand? Not at all. Love is consistent with kindness, but it is not consistent with compromising the truth. The Bible strongly warns against calling evil good and good evil. Love doesn't disregard falsehood or unrighteousness, but as much as possible, it focuses on what's true and what's right. It looks for the good. It hopes for the good. It emphasizes the good. It doesn't dwell or focus on the wrongs of others. It doesn't parade their faults for the whole world to see. When love sees a brother or sister act inappropriately, it doesn't call them out publicly and humiliate them. Jesus teaches in Matthew 18, verse 15, if your brother sins against you, go and show him your fault just between the two of you. Catch that? Privately, one-on-one. See, we want to jump to step three of the process. See, if you read down to verse 17, it says, tell it to the church. And unfortunately, what happens in most cases is we do the third step before the first step. Somebody does something wrong, and what do? Oh, did you know what somebody... Oh, did you hear what's up? We tell everybody else except the person that did it. Or allegedly did it. Maybe they didn't even do it, but boy, the whole church knows before anything has come about. We've got to be very careful. When we see somebody caught up in a wrong, go to them directly, go to them personally. When we talk to others about someone else, it's gossip. When we talk to the one who is in the wrong, when we can approach them in gentleness and restore them, that's love. You know, Paul's not the only New Testament writer to use that Greek word agape. It appears twice in 1 Peter 4:8. Above all, love each other deeply because love covers a multitude of sins. See, where love abounds in a fellowship of Christians, many small offenses, even large ones, are readily forgiven. But where love is lacking, every word is viewed with suspicion. Every action is liable to misunderstanding. Conflicts abound, and this is what the devil delights in. Proverbs 10:12 says, hatred stirs up dissension, but love covers over all wrongs. I think this is graphically illustrated in a story about Noah. Now, what do we know about Noah? The ark. I mean, that's what he's known for. That's what he's famous for. Noah was a good man. He was a righteous man, but he wasn't perfect. And Genesis 9 records an incident after the flood that took place in Noah's life. In Genesis 9, beginning in verse 20, Noah, a man of the soil, meaning a farmer, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, one of Noah's sons, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backward and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father's nakedness. I don't think this text is so much about Noah's sin as the reaction of his sons. We're told that Ham went out and told his brothers about it. Now, we're not told what the conversation was, but can you imagine how that went? Can you imagine the tone that Ham probably would have had when he called his brothers over? Hey, guys, check this out. Right? Don't you think that was kind of the attitude that he had? Look at the old man. And we know that he had something wrong with the way that he reacted, because when Noah sobered up, he was very unhappy with Ham. So I'm sure that Ham had this attitude of, hey guys, check this out. But what does Shem and Japheth do? They don't delight in their father's sin. They don't make fun of the consequences of that sin. But they very literally covered it over. And just picture yourself, these two brothers, they've got a blanket and they're just kind of walking in and, you know, covering them up. Not even going to look. That's love. That's what Paul is writing about in 1 Corinthians 13:6. See, like Noah's sons, we should seek to cover the sins of others and then help make things right. Now, I'm not talking about sweeping something under the rug or excusing something that's wrong. I'm saying we don't make light of it. We don't take a perverse joy in what somebody else has done that's wrong. Even when dealing with others who consistently live in a sinful lifestyle, love looks for the best in that person. Now, love isn't ignoring the sin. It's not making it acceptable, but it looks past the behavior to the soul made in the image of God and for whom Christ died. And that makes all the difference in the world. You see, rather than labeling somebody by their behavior, instead of calling somebody an alcoholic, calling them an addict, calling them a homosexual, see, that label depersonalizes somebody. You look beyond that and you see here is a person created in God's image for whom Christ died. John 3:16 applies to them. God so loved that person that He sent His one and only Son. Love looks beyond the sin and sees the sinner as God sees them. And God loves them. See, that's that fine line between hating the sin and loving the sinner. Loving the sinner does not mean that you accept the sin, but hating the sin does not mean that you hate the sinner. I'm sure you've all heard the stories of this church in Kansas that goes to the funerals and protests, you know, and God hates these certain people. No, He doesn't. They are dead wrong. Now, I'm not saying that the sin they're talking about isn't sin. But taking an attitude of hatred toward the people is absolutely contrary to what the Bible teaches. We are not called to hate anyone. Period. I don't care what they've done. We are not called to hate anybody. We are called to hate sin. But there's a big difference between hating a sinner and hating their sin. And likewise, there's a difference between loving a sinner and loving their sin. See, a lot of people will say, well, if you love me, then you'll accept what I do. No. God doesn't do that. But you can still love the person and acknowledge that what they're doing is still wrong in the eyes of God. And we can show them lovingly where they can find forgiveness, where they can find freedom from those sins. But it must be done in an attitude of love. We do everything in our power to bring these people to the Savior, because love means wanting what's best. And what is better for anybody than coming to Christ and finding new life? So I return to my opening question. Want to hear good news or bad news? There's plenty of bad news out there. It's easy to get caught up in the evil in our world. But God's love doesn't delight in evil. It rejoices with the truth. So what is our focus going to be?